This is Elliot Gould, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
Good afternoon, friends. This is Maria Hall welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. Jim Lafferty is on vacation today, so he won't be here, but I will hold down the fort and he'll be back next week. So we'll be glad to see him. And on this week's show, please stay tuned because we'll be speaking to two women who are on the front lines of protecting our constitutional and human rights. In the first half hour, we'll speak with immigration law specialist Lisa Ramirez, who will help us understand what's going on in LA and Orange County related to immigration and what advocates are doing to support families. Then I'll speak with Lydia Camarillo, the president of Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, about what's going on in Texas with the GOP-led efforts to redistrict and disempower the Latino vote. So let's jump right in. Well, back on June 22nd, 2025, we saw dramatic video of Border Patrol agents in masks chasing down, tackling, and repeatedly punching a man while he was helpless on the ground. We later learned that man's name, Narciso Barranca of Santa Ana, California, the father of three U.S. Marines. With an outpouring of community support and the representation by the brilliant lawyer you'll meet in a moment, Mr. Barranca was granted bond, released from detention, and is now home with his family. But Mr. Barranca himself has acknowledged most are not so lucky. Immigrant advocates continue to search for those arrested and grapple with the panic caused by ICE enforcement operations in our neighborhoods. And for people of conscience who don't want our tax dollars spent terrorizing communities, separating families, and ignoring due process and human rights, it leaves us wondering, what can we do? Well, our guest this segment, attorney Lisa Ramirez, will help us understand this moment in U.S. history in real time. You might have seen Lisa on the news with her client, Narciso Barranca, but her journey as an immigration lawyer started long ago. She's a California State Bar Immigration and Nationality Law Specialist, and notably one of the first women and the first Spanish-speaking immigration law specialists in Orange County. Lisa is one of the rare lawyers who knows about all kinds of immigration law, from advising employers to obtaining visas for visitors to representing individuals like Mr. Barranca. Lisa Ramirez, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Well, as I mentioned, your client, Mr. Barranca, is one of the fortunate people who were actually taken into custody and then released. Can you give us a summary of the process he went through from the time he was arrested on June 22nd to when he was released on July 15th? And let us know, why was he being chased in the first place? Where was he taken? Who was he with when he was in custody? And how was he treated?
So as to the question in terms of, you know, why was he chased, there was no legal basis for Mr. Barranca to have been chased, much less, you know, arrested, treated the way he was, apprehended and placed into custody. What we know about the facts, and I think many of your listeners have probably seen the video footage, you know, the only incident that, you know, Mr. Barranca was doing at the time of his apprehension was his job. He has been a hardworking individual for 30 years. He is a gardener. He's a very proud gardener. And he was at work. He was at work doing what he does best, which is taking care of, you know, property and lawns of businesses and residences throughout Southern California. And so the only thing that we can conclude is, you know, The apprehension was quite arbitrary. It's probably based on racial profiling, a presumption being made that someone who looks like Mr. Barranco, being of, you know, dark colored skin, is present in the United States without authorization. However, they never asked, they never questioned, they never inquired, nor did they ever identify themselves to Mr. Barranco. So you can imagine it was quite frightening for someone to be pulled off the streets from his job unexpectedly with no, you know, basis really for it. So it's tragic. Obviously, he's not the only one. He was taken to Los Angeles downtown, where he remained there for about 3 days. And he was in temporary custody until they could transfer him to the Adelanto detention facility out in Adelanto, California. He was in custody with, you know, a large number of, you know, immigrants from various countries from around the world. There are a significant a number of Mexican nationals that are in Adelanto. We work closely with the Mexican consulate out in San Bernardino, as they're the ones tasked to, you know, visiting those individuals inside the facility. You know, if anyone, you know, those listeners that may not be familiar with conditions of these detention facilities, you know, we've really gone from facilities that used to be public. So here in Orange County, for example, we had Santa Ana Jail. We had the, you know, Sheriff's Department had another facility. And I know that it was, you know, community efforts that really pushed ICE out of the county. I was very concerned and probably a lone voice at the time, because we knew that if those facilities closed, it was going to push people further away from their families and visitors, from legal representation, from the evidence and witnesses that they would need to participate, you know, in their hearings. I think what makes it worse with the privatization of these facilities is that there's no oversight or accountability, where we could before hold our elected officials accountable when we heard of deplorable conditions, substandard, you know, food and environment conditions at these facilities. Now it's extremely difficult to address. And even when we become aware of these conditions, very difficult to get a response from ICE or even acknowledgement that the conditions exist. So, you know, the food is really bad. The conditions are very bad. We did have an incident where, according to detainees at the facility, while Mr. Barranco was there, there was a sewage leak that started in the morning and really did not get addressed until the evening. ICE was not responsive, did not acknowledge. They would provide no information to any attorney. We did seek, you know, the assistance of the Mexican consulate. They had shut down the facility, so no one was really able to verify what was happening at the time it was happening. And it was shut down, I believe, throughout the weekend. You know, thankfully, Mr. Barranco has since been released. However, he is still pained and concerned about his cellmates and the people that he came to know and build relationships with while he was there.
Well, speaking of that, we know that Mr. Barranco was able to get out on bond. And I think most of us are familiar with the concept of getting out, being released on bond in the criminal law context, which is most of the time pretty automatic, unless in really bad situations. But what does it mean in the immigration context? How hard is it to get that bond? And what happens when people do?
So bond has always been challenging, right, for individuals to qualify for. So they need to be able to demonstrate that they're, you know, not a threat to the community, not a national security threat, that they're not going to flee, right, that they're going to continue to show up at their future immigration hearings that they might have. That's kind of what I would say has been the normal standard for at least the last 25 years that I've been practicing. What's really changed today is really two aspects. One is procedural and the other is policy. On the procedural side, you know, it took 8 days for our motion for a bond hearing to be accepted by the courts, right? So that was extraordinarily a long period of time for the court to accept that that motion. And so much so that, you know, I had called many times to ensure that, you know, at Mr. Barranco's first hearing that we would be able to request bond. the morning of the hearing, it still had not been accepted, had not been uploaded. Speaking with the clerks that are often recently hired and not very experienced, claimed that they had not received our bond motion, despite that we had confirmation by email from the system itself. Everything has gone electronic, which in some senses is good. I mean, the immigration systems, I'd say, are probably far behind the, superior court systems and filings. However, when those filings are being blocked by people who have to have time to review and accept them, then it really is a hindrance. So the morning of his hearing, I had called, not being able to access, the portal as of yet, and they said it was probably something technical. I needed to call technical support. Going back and forth, I won't go into a long explanation, but basically that person was incorrect. It really just needed to be accepted. I offered to provide a paper version. Luckily, we had a really great judge. And so when we showed up that day for his initial hearing, the judge had commented that we had just filed the motion for bond that day. And I corrected him and basically said, no, it was filed 8 days ago. It's taken that long for their court staff to accept those motions. Now, that's when you have an attorney. So you can only imagine how much longer it is procedurally to be able to request bond from the immigration court. On the other side of it, once we were granted bond 2 days later, thankfully the judge was kind enough to give us a court date very quickly. It took more than 24 hours for the court to upload the judge's order, which meant that the family could not post bond because ICE could not see that bond had been granted. And so they were not able to post it until after 2 o'clock on Friday. ICE closes at 3 o'clock in terms of, processing bonds. So despite the fact that they filed before three, it wouldn't be processed until that following Monday. So this extraordinary delay, and I think, the explanation from court staff, and I don't think any one person is to blame, is obviously the floodgates have opened. There are far more cases and filings than they have capacity to handle. And so it's created this incredible bottleneck. Now, once, that's on the procedural side. Now, the policy side, which are just additional hurdles that have been recently implemented by this administration, essentially there's some individuals that are subject to mandatory detention because of past criminal history, but that category being put aside, there's individuals that are, classified under two different sections of the law, one allowing for bond and the other not allowing for bond. And essentially what this administration has done, it has attempted to reclassify as many people under the section of law that does not allow them to even request bond. And so for many people in this category, obviously with a lawyer, you can really challenge the basis on which the government is classifying them. But if you don't have a lawyer, you really don't have, the knowledge and the expertise that you need to really challenge what the government is asserting. So for those individuals, they will remain in custody for the duration of the removal proceedings. What to make matters worse, and probably many of your listeners have heard, is that, sometimes these detainees get moved. They don't stay in one location. There was a case recently of an individual that I think had been moved to four different states. And so you can only imagine the challenges that lawyers have to chasing and finding their client, to filing with the new court, and then they lose jurisdiction because the physical body has now been relocated. So I think, it's been extremely difficult. It was already difficult before, but qualifying for bond has now, required extra legal effort and expertise. And if the individual doesn't have family members, doesn't have someone who can, assure the government that they have a place to live, that they're going to be financially provided for, then essentially there's no chance for bond.
Wow. Well, this is a masterclass that you've been taking in real world, trying to deal with all of, taking all of your knowledge, I'm sure, and learning, your learning curve must be really steep as well. So can you share with us some of the key takeaways from your experience representing Mr. Barranco during this whole ordeal? And what can we all learn from it?
Yeah, so I think what's really critical, because the world, the rules, the laws, the policies are changing daily. So the policy that I mentioned about classifying people differently, that came out at 2:30 the day before Mr. Bronco's hearing. So for us that work in this field, we are constantly having to check, you know, what changes have happened. Is there anything that's going to, you know, be different that I need to be prepared for before going into court? I think, you know, the other significant change is the government, you know, dismissing cases regardless of people having, you know, credible relief available to them, so that they can just purely apprehend them, detain them, and deport them, and really trying to get rid of people as quickly as possible. So there was a recent case that deemed those individuals that had been entered the United States on parole. The government had been subjecting those people to what we call expedited removal, which means that they don't get due process. They do not have the opportunity to have their case heard in court. Thankfully, that is no longer the case. Those individuals, you know, will need legal representation for those that had their cases dismissed. But at least we need to protect due process as much as possible. And I think for me personally, the learnings have been, I don't think I realized how fragile our democracy is in this country. I think I was always raised and taught we had the three branches of government. That's what created the balance of power, the oversight, the accountability that would really make, you know, our Constitution work, thrive, and our democracy. And I think what I've very quickly come to learn is that when there are powers and that control all three of those branches, we are extremely vulnerable. And that's not just immigrants, that's all Americans. And so I think for me, the best advice I have to people, and this is not a plug for just any lawyer, but it's really important that you have a good legal representation and that you're connected with the nonprofit communities, you know, organizations like the ACLU that are doing the heavy lifting, right? We need to bring to light and surface so many of the grave abuses and injustices that are happening. Mr. Bronco is one of thousands. And so thankfully, his family had the courage to bring his story to light. And we can only hope that more Americans and, you know, lawful permanent residents, mixed status family members can be as courageous and to bring forth, you know, the injustice and to hopefully wake up the rest of this country to take a stand and to work for change.
Well, speaking of courage and speaking of immigration lawyers like you, Lisa Ramirez, last month, The Atlantic published an article by Nick Miroff called Trump Loves ICE. Its workforce has never been so miserable. And then that article states, quote, a mission impossible deportation campaign has left many employees, that is ICE agents, burned out and morally conflicted. Morally conflicted. End quote. So the enforcers are getting burned out is what I'm hearing. And we know that they've been offering these outrageously high salaries. But what about immigration lawyers? I'm sure you've been the target of haters and retaliation, and as well as your other immigration lawyer colleagues. What keeps you all energized and on the front lines? And how can the public best support you?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. I obviously can't speak for every immigration practitioner, but I think we're most definitely under attack and we need to collaborate and cooperate together more than ever. I am grateful and thankful that I have a team here at my office. I don't think I could do this work alone, but I know that there are a lot of solo practitioners in the area of immigration. And so we need to build and find our community. We can't do everything and we can't do it all. We can just do what we can do with what's in front of us. And that's something I have to really reiterate to my own staff and our staff attorneys here. Self-care is critical because we need to be able to have the endurance for the long fight that's ahead. I hate to say it, but they're just getting started. We haven't seen anything yet. There's a lot more work to be done. And so to the extent that we can take better care of ourselves, to the extent that we can support each other, is going to be very critical. And It was the Guardian today that featured an article about a California attorney who was hit with sanctions by the Department of Justice because of what they claim to have, you know, filed meritless, frivolous claims, which, you know, I was accustomed for the courts to be the ones to issue those sanctions or determine if a filing is, you know, meritless or frivolous. However, we know that this is a very strong PR message that is being sent by this administration to really scare civil rights attorneys, immigration attorneys, and, you know, perhaps convince them to quit, retire, go do something else. But that can't be our response. I think right now, more than ever, we really need to join forces and seek support and take time off when time off is needed and warranted. And we really have to do this collaboratively. Otherwise, we won't be able to do it at all.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is KPFK 90.7 FM, The Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall. Co-host Jim Lafferty he has the day off today, but he'll be back next week. And I'm speaking with immigration attorney Lisa Ramirez. So, Lisa, I know you've been actively involved with community education in both Orange and LA counties. How have outreach efforts changed to reach immigrant families who might be afraid to, you know, go to the legal clinics at organizations or, you know, otherwise be out in public? And what can listeners do to help get reliable information to their neighbors who may not want to leave the house?
Yeah. So I think each response for every community is going to be different and unique. I think the listeners probably know their community best. But what I will say, you know, first and foremost, I mean, this is a different game. The rules have changed. So perhaps at a time where we're used to kind of promoting and announcing, you know, naturalization fairs or consultation clinics or family preparedness clinics or Know Your Rights, that has not been our approach during this administration at all. I feel like we've had to go underground and be subtle. And I don't want to say secretive because it's really by trusted word of mouth. Get out, people do come, but it's really identifying where are those safe, secure, trusted places where people will show up. And what we have found, it's the schools and it's the churches. And I say churches in the broadest sense. It could be the mosques, the temples, you know, whatever the place of religious worship may be. That's where people are used to going. However, recently, I will say, is I think people are so afraid to even go there. So then the question has become, how do we continue doing our work? How do we continue reaching, you know, our community? And the model that we've kind of begun to turn to is, you know, home visits, hotlines, trying to be as responsive to people where they're at. And that's going to be, you know, it's going to take some innovation and creativity to make sure that we're going to them and not expecting them to come to us. And so the stronger that we can build these coalitions in our, you know, respective community here in Orange County, we have the Orange County Immigration Coalition, which is a group of a number of organizations and school districts and people who come together to really talk through what they're seeing on the ground and how can we as community respond to the needs. And they change and they evolve. We meet, you know, every 2 weeks. And I would say every 2 weeks, there's a lot that is changed and transpired. But I think it's going to require us to be a lot more creative, perhaps, than what we're used to be able to get good information out to the community that needs it most. Right now, I think the most critical piece, at least from my perspective, is really trying to get the community to understand the importance of preparedness, right? And that means having a plan, having a childcare safety plan, having the information that whoever the caregiver may be, whether it's an adult child, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's an aunt, an uncle, a sister, knows, you know, the basic information of your children, where they go to school, who their doctors are, do they have special needs and allergies, who's their, you know, physician, and even go beyond that and either have, you know, a power of attorney for minors in place. They have it here in California. We're very lucky. We have the California Caregivers Authorization Affidavit. It's very simple, but it's limited to school and medical needs. But there are options for people to be prepared. There's nothing that pains me more than when I have a client who has minor children who did nothing and those children are either in custody of ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or they're taken into custody, you know, by our system. So that between that and then having a power of attorney for their things, right? So if they're in detention, they're going to need money for bond. They might need money for legal representation. And I've had at least two people, you know, have been detained, have the money, but they have no one to access it because they don't have the power of attorney in place that someone can access their finances, the money that they have in the bank. So preparedness is key, and really being a resource in terms of how we can help people get prepared, I think, is the most important thing we can do.
Mm-hmm. And I know you've been so active with training other lawyers, non-immigration lawyers, too, to do this kind of work. Most of us learn how to do this, you know, in order to pass the bar. And then dealing with also those future planning. And then even pets, I remember you saying before, because if a person is single and they have an animal at home, who's going to take care of their pet? But there's ways to deal with that, too, as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all of the details, right? It's the things that we perhaps take for granted. It's the, you know, it's the paying of the rent if you don't want to lose your, you know, apartment. It's the pets, it's the children, it's, you know, the electricity, it's everything. It's all the details that we perhaps, you know, on autopilot think we don't need to worry about. And it's just having a plan, right? Have you have your plan A, right? With A is you're going to be fine and you're never taken into custody, but have that plan B. So at least if a neighbor, a trusted relative has the key to your place and that they can then know that, you know, action needs to be taken and handle business on your behalf.
Yeah. And anytime there's panic out there, and I know we are running out of time, but I wanted to get a couple more questions in. I know that people are especially vulnerable to scams and to, you know, unscrupulous people trying to take advantage of that, you know, you getting their money and not doing something or doing something wrong, which can be devastating in the immigration context. Are there some red flags people should look for in order to avoid being scammed?
I think that there's a lot, right? And we do a whole section on immigration fraud. It's extremely prevalent. And so if someone promises something and it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Before you pay that individual, get a second opinion, right? I'd rather you pay for a second consultation and just confirm whether or not their advice that they're given is true or not. If you don't have access to the attorney, that to me is an automatic red flag. There's a number of offices that are high volume, and the work is primarily handled by non-attorneys. And so you want to make sure that whoever it is that you're hiring has the, you know, competence, expertise, and the availability to give your case the time and attention it needs. Make sure you get things in writing, sign a contract, right? Make sure you get receipts for payments that are made, because if that business closes tomorrow, and it happens all the time, there will be very little recourse for you to be able to, you know, take action or get those dollars back. So I would always recommend people, if you have no idea where to start, you know, look at Yelp reviews, look at Google reviews, and then I would also encourage people to go to the Department of, you can Google Department of Justice accredited organizations and start there. You can find a link, you can look by state. These are nonprofit organizations that may or may not have lawyers on staff, but they at least have the training to handle immigration related work. And they typically have a list of trusted lawyers that they work with. So I would always say start there with the DOJ accredited organization before kind of randomly, you know, going off of someone on TV or the radio.
And what about trusted sources of information? Are there some go-to websites that you would suggest people look for?
Yeah, so I think it depends on how nitty-gritty. I don't know. It's overwhelming. Truthfully, it's overwhelming for me with all the news and information. So I think, you know, go local. We have a newsletter here in our office that we disseminate to our clients and anyone who basically signs up through our website. You don't ever have to have been a client, because we really think it's important that people stay abreast of the most important news as it comes out. We probably send a newsletter out once a month, but that way you're not getting bombarded or overwhelmed. The American Immigration Lawyers Association, to me, is a go-to source. It's obviously, I don't think any lawyer could practice immigration law without being a member. So they have some really good resources. You can even go to, you know, alalawyer.org and find a member that you may wish to represent you near your area. And then there's other groups. I think, you know, speaking here locally, you know, CHIRLA has a great information on their website. There's Immigrant Defenders that has some good information, Public Law Center here in Orange County. So you really have to look to find who are the players in your community that are actively engaged in working on issues related to immigration. And they often have, you know, blog posts. We're doing TikTok videos now, which I never wanted to do, but everybody said, please, could you please? So now we're doing daily TikTok, Instagram, you know, trying to hit the social media because we know that's really where people live to get information.
Well, please, before we go, let us know all of those hashtags and where people can find you and your firm and in all of this great information.
Yeah, probably the best place to start is at our website, which is usilg.net. It stands for US Immigration Law Group.net. There you can sign up for a newsletter if you're interested. Also, if you scroll to the bottom of the page, they have direct links. I know to at least our Facebook and our Instagram, TikTok link coming soon because it's brand new. You can search U.S. Immigration Law Group on Instagram, on TikTok. We're putting out, you know, daily content to what we perceive to be the most asked questions or issues that are rising that folks really need to know about.
Wow. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Attorney Lisa Ramirez, wonderful to talk to you, and I'll be seeing you soon.
Great. Thank you, Maria, for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. Well, everyone stay tuned. We're going to leave for a very quick station ID break, and then we'll be right back with another great interview.
This is Stephanie Wells, Executive Director of Pacifica Foundation. Congress has defunded public media, threatening the survival of television and radio stations that provide trusted news, emergency alerts, and vital community connection. Years of corporate media consolidation and deregulation have taken media out of community hands, while social media platforms cut back on fact-checking, leaving communities vulnerable to misinformation. In this time of social crisis and climate emergencies, local stations provide vital information for keeping our community safe. You can help by supporting and donating to your local community media. This message comes to you in solidarity from the Pacifica Foundation.
Well, we are back. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall. My co-host Jim Lafferty has the day off today, but he'll be back next week. Today's guest, I had to end up, we pre-recorded because she's on an airplane right now. So I'm just going to sit back and listen, and you can all enjoy the pre-recorded interview that we took just yesterday, so it's still up to date, but enjoy.
We turn now to the subject of the GOP-led plan to redraw voting districts in Texas. It's meant to give Republicans at least 5 more seats in Congress, and of course the upper hand to Trump in upcoming elections. Opponents have sounded the alarm. Texas Democratic lawmakers fled the state to stop the plan from moving forward. Blue states are considering redistricting now as a counterweight to any Republican gains. And many civic leaders, including our next guest, warn that the plan is unlawful, intended to dilute Latino voter power, in violation of the Voting Rights Act and the U.S. Constitution. Our guest today will help us understand both the big picture and the nuances in this historic power struggle. Lydia Camarillo serves as the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the oldest Latino voter registration nonprofit, which empowers Latinos throughout the United States to mobilize voters. Lydia plays a key role in developing the tactical strategies for nonpartisan voter registration, voter education, and get out the vote campaigns. She served as CEO of the 2000 Democratic National Convention, and prior to joining Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, she served as the National Director of the Leadership Development Program for the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, MALDEF. Lydia Camarillo, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yes. Well, can you start out by giving us some basic statistics? How many registered voters are there in Texas? How many of each political party? And what are the largest groups by ethnicity?
Well, let's remember that in Texas, it's not like California where you can state what party you're in. So you don't really have a good sense of who's the party. And people who vote in primaries, much, much less folks vote into primary. And we do have a lot of crossovers. But I can tell you the following. There is an estimated, and the numbers are evolving as we're in the mid-decade time, but there are an estimated 4 million registered Latino voters that are Latino, and it's the second largest, second to white voters, and larger than Black and Asian American voters. But it is a growing electorate, and I have to tell you that when I first started working at Southwest Voter, and a long time ago, because I started in 94, I have to share with you that the registration numbers for Latinos were stagnating. It would grow to 2.6 million, 2.5, 2.7, and it stayed like that until 2016. And then we went, you know, again, we have 4 million and it's actually going to be 4.1 million, but we have to verify that. So registered voters, again, second to California, registered voters. And we're very excited. It's growing. It's making a big difference. And we're part of that effort.
Well, before we dive into the controversy over the redistricting of Congress members that's in the news right now, can you tell us, explain how many Congress members there are currently in Texas and what's their breakdown by political party?
There's 38 Congress members, but we also have to remember that the census is counted every 10 years. And in 2010, there was a dramatic growth powered by the Latino community as well as this last cycle in 2020. And as a result of that, in the last cycle in 2010, Texas gained 4 new congressional districts. And as a result of the growth in 2020, Texas grew by another 3 new congressional members. Out of the 38 congressional members, 80% are going to be determined by white voters, and in most cases, if not all, by Republican voters who will determine their candidate of choice. This redistricting effort is very difficult for the Latino community because, let me first say that the conversation nationally and in Texas is that the Republicans are going to gain 5 new Republican districts, where voters that are Republican will elect their preferred candidate, which will be a Republican candidate. But what's not being discussed is a dismantling of Latino districts that are actually Section 2 voting rights districts, as well as several African-American districts that are also being dismantled. And we can break that down in this program. But it's important that we note that the loss isn't just about partisan issues. For those of you that are Democrats, you're going to feel the crisis. Every midterm, after a presidential cycle and a midterm, the president that's in the White House will lose congressional houses. And so right now they're in control and they are at risk of losing the House. So President Trump, in order to protect himself, has asked Governor Abbott to find 5 seats. But it's at the cost of the Latino community and the Black community, and primarily the Latino community. And like I said, I can break that down for us.
Yes, please do so, because we're wondering, you know, what do they expect to gain and how might it impact these, you called it the Voting Rights Act?
Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
So, yeah, please explain that a little bit more.
Well, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act has to do with language speaking voters, which is Spanish speakers in this case, because we're Latino. And so District 29, which is one of the districts that was noted by the Justice Department to Governor Abbott to change it and move it, was clearly a Latino majority district or Latino opportunity district from the legal term sense. But it was a Latino majority district where Latinos have elected for quite almost two decades have decided that district. And it's a Latina, Silvia Garcia, who is currently the congressional woman. But that district, it will no longer elect a candidate. Latinos will no longer be able to elect a candidate choice. So that's a protected district under Section 2, and it's being dismantled. There's also Congressional District 35 and 33 that were approved by the, we sued, Southeast Voter is one of the plaintiffs that sued in 2011, and we sued in 2021 on the Texas redistricting maps because we believe that they not only violate the Voting Rights Act and the U.S. Constitution, but its objective is to give no voice and no power to the Latino community, especially, as I said, we have grown. Put this into context. There's 31 million people in Texas, of which 13 million plus are Latino and 12 million are white. So we're talking about Latinos losing their voice completely. It's being stumped, if I may say those words, through the ballot, through these districts. 35 is the district that is out of San Antonio to Austin, where Greg Cesar, the Congress member, rather, will lose his seat because, again, it's drawn where Latinos will no longer have a voice and will not be able to elect a candidate of choice. Southwest Voter, through MALDEV, I'm the chair of the Texas Redistricting Task Force, and MALDEV is our legal representative, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. We put together a map suggesting that 35 be created as a Latino majority district and that 33 out of Dallas and Fort Worth be created as a Latino majority district. The courts decided to create 35 and 33, again, protected districts. We move forward. It's now 2021. And again, we gained 3 new congressional districts after the Latino population growth. And what happens? We lose those 2 districts. And now we're also losing, like I said, the 29th, the 28th, the 34. So we're losing a total of 5 districts that are all dismantling Latinos. Additionally, CD9 and CD18, which is in Houston, are being collapsed into one, and therefore the African-American community, instead of having 2 districts, will only have 1.
Wow. Well, how are Texas Democrats and others resisting the redistricting plan? And of course, just as important, how are they staying courageous and strong amidst really serious attacks by opponents?
Well, we have to remember that this is not the first time that the state of Texas has drawn congressional maps and statewide and Senate maps that dilute the Latino vote and the African-American vote and other communities. But this cycle is interesting and terrifying because it's being determined in the mid-decades. There's no need to do that. We had the census count, and based on that data, the states were allocated the congressional numbers. As I said, we gained another 3. And so we went to a total of 38 congressional districts. And from that, it's a result of the population growth. And instead of having the representation that we should deserve as a population that is part of this state and making the difference, we're not seeing that. The Democrats that are part of the state legislators have very few remedies because they're a minority and they don't have the votes in the legislature. This map will become a law, and it will be signed by Abbott once they figure out when they can all be in the House to vote and have a quorum. Minority state members can exit the state and use the breaking quorum as a strategy to push whatever their constituencies want. And in this case, they, we don't want this map. And so they've left, and they did that in the last, in 2021, they did that in 2011. This has been done for a number of cycles, and they leave the state. The problem with that is that they're getting fined. It costs money to stay out of the state. And remember, we're not like California where the legislators work every day. The legislators in Texas only work during the odd years in this cycle, and they work from January to May. And then if there's special elections, they're 30 elections, and they're not paid hardly any money. So most of the legislators, if not 100%, have other jobs. And so they're also losing money in the, from their homes, and then whatever it costs to be outside. Also, at the request of Congress, Senator Cornyn, United States Senator Cornyn, the FBI is following them and trying to figure out how they bring him in. At the end of the day, I think that Abbott will call several sessions. We'll see how long the Texas legislators can hold out and be out of state. But they will eventually, he will eventually hold a special session, which every special session can only be 30 days, and they will be able to vote this map. So then the next question becomes, what do community groups like Southwest Voter and MALDEF and LULAC and other groups that are part of this coalition, the Latino Redistricting Task Force, what do we do? What's our remedy to make sure that we continue to have a voice? Our remedy has been to sue the state of Texas. In the last cycle in 2011, we sued. We won the two districts that I just mentioned, the 35 and the 33. We also sued at the state house, and we won. This time in 2021, we also sued, but our case was litigated by MALDEF in the federal court in El Paso, and that case is being stalled. And I say stalled because they're not going to act on anything until we know what Texas legislature is doing. And it may take a while before we find out what it is that the courts will do, depending on what the state does. For Southwest Voter and the groups that are part of the coalition, the Texas Latino Redistricting Coalition, as well as other groups, MALC, the Mexican American Legislative Caucus, which also sued, the NAACP, the different parties and the different members of Congress, which will probably sue. We have to decide, how does this map become part of our 2021 lawsuit, or do we sue, create another lawsuit to stop this from happening? But at the end of the day, as I said, we went from 9 Latino majority districts that were created in 2011. We then gained a total of 7 congressional suites, districts between the last cycle and this cycle. And yet we're down to 4 Latino majority districts, 4, in a state where Texas is truly a majority Latino state.
How diverse are the political parties of Latino majority areas?
Latino voters have voted traditionally in favor of the Democratic candidates from the top of the ticket, whether it's for president or governor, or and then congressional, state house, assembly seats, et cetera. But in recent years, there's been a shift at the presidential level to vote more conservative in the South Texas. That's not true in the whole state. And it's also not true that it's 100%. And it's also not true that it's moved as dramatically as people think. And we're doing a study at Southwest Voter, and we'll get the results later, to figure out if in fact it's a permanent shift, an ongoing shift, a continuing shift, or a one-time shift. I know it has to do with the economy. Folks who voted for Trump in 2024 in the Valley, the Rio Grande Valley, they voted because they either work for the oil industry, customs, the INS, and they, for some reason, these voters believe that the only way they keep their jobs is if they vote for the Republican candidates. But they did not vote in the same way for Congress. they voted, the vote, there was a split. They voted for the Democratic candidate. I believe that that's still going to be the case for the congressional districts. And I think it will also be the case for the U.S. Senate seat. Texas may become, depending on what happens with John Cornyn, if he gets a true challenger. He has several challengers in the primary, but if he loses, that becomes a true competitive district for the U.S. Senate, state for the U.S. Senate.
If you're just tuning in, this is KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Maria Hall, co-host of The Lawyers Guild Show. My co-host Jim Lafferty has the day off today, but he'll be back next week. And right now, I'm interviewing Lydia Camarillo, president of Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. So still on the subject of redistricting, I wanted to ask one more question on that subject. Now, you know, if in response to, you know, what's happening in Texas, then, of course, California and New York are saying, well, then we'll just redistrict as well. And then apparently GOP-led efforts are also going through Missouri and Indiana. So now what if the whole country decides to redistrict? What's sort of the impact of that slippery slope?
Well, I think that it's a mistake to create redistricting efforts in the mid-decade. First of all, we have a history, a precedent of doing it every 10 years. It's a result of right after we find out how many people live in our states, how many left our states, and then consequentially each state will either gain or lose congressional districts. That was the case for Texas. We've already have done this. The issue becomes that red states, like the states you mentioned, they do not have commissions that draw the districts. And California does. And because of that, and I understand that the Governor Newsom is really trying hard and figuring out a strategy to do have a mid-decade response to the Texas maps, should they become law. And I also understand that he wrote a letter specifically to Trump and Abbott saying, drop it or we'll move it. The question for me becomes, as I watch Texas and we do work in California as well, is California going to be able to hold midterm elections in time? Change the district's mid-decade in time for the elections. That's the question. And I believe that New York and Illinois are thinking about the same thing. And so let's assume that there's a 10 to 15 districts that are found between Texas and the other red states. California can gain probably as many as 7 or 8. But is it going to be at the stake again to protect Democrats and build Democratic districts at the expense of the Latino electorate and violating Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act to create those districts? Either way, it's very difficult. And I think those of us that are following and protecting democracy have to remember that it's not just about partisan. It's about Latinos having a voice and the opportunity to elect their candidate of choice, as well as the other communities that are part of that particular state or the nation at the end of the day.
On a related topic, last week, Trump instructed the Commerce Department to change how it collects census data. And they want to exclude people who are living in the United States, but who are undocumented, and they want to not count those people. So what would be the consequences of a change like that? And the second half of the question is, given that the census isn't even until 2030, why do you think Trump is making this announcement now?
Well, because Trump and the administration is looking to find a way to sustain its power and balance it out. We already filed a lawsuit when Trump was president in the last cycle, in his first time as president, and that's what exactly he wanted to do. They wanted to do two things. Excludes non-citizens from the census count and exclude non-citizens from the apportionment process. We sued, as well as other groups. Southwest Voters sued. Maldiv was our litigator in this effort, and we won. We believe that the Constitution clearly says every person should be counted. Every person that lives in the United States must be counted. It has implications not only about the congressional districts and the legislators, how they're going to be drawing and down the city council commissions, supervisors, and so forth, but it has consequences on who lives here, who needs resources for education, who the healthcare question, all the issues related to federal resources and state resources. We need to know who is in our communities, in our neighborhoods, precinct by precinct, so that we can then try to provide a better service. That's why it's needed. So in the last cycle, we sued, we won. I believe that that would be the case again. Now, in both cases, should we end up before the Supreme Court in the redistricting lawsuit, or in this case for the census count and or reapportionment, we still have to worry about are the judges that are in the federal courts and that are members of the Supreme Court, are they going to respond legally to what the law has said and the president has said, or are they going to be partisans, even though part of their job is to be not partial and try to abide by the letter of the law?
Absolutely. The question we've all been watching. So speaking of, a lot of moving parts here, you and personally have spent decades of your life empowering voters, especially Hispanic voters. So for listeners who may be feeling, like all the news is bad out there and we don't know what the judges are going to do and we're all on pins and needles, can you give us some tips on how to stay inspired and energized and how to feel like, kind of counter the learned helplessness of just watching bad news all the time? How can one person make a difference even in these challenging times?
I think that's an excellent question. It's one that I ask myself every day. But here at Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, we think that the glass is half full, never half empty. Therefore, we have challenges, and every victory that the civil rights community has gained, it's been at a cost. And in some cases, at personal lives have been at stake and people have died for the right to vote, to stop voter suppression. And we will continue to do that. But you can make sure that you register, you vote, that your family does the same thing. Every single time that you can think of, there's an election, and do not think that it doesn't matter. Whether it's a local election that you might not make a difference. We just had the 2024 elections, but in the city of Los Angeles, in the county of Los Angeles, we had Measure G. No matter where you believed or what you thought on Measure G, we're not going to have more Board of Supervisors members. And hopefully that means more representation for the millions of Latinos that right now do not have a voice, except for the voice that one member gives us.
Well, also, what advice do you have for listeners who want to become more informed and politically active? What can they do?
Well, I invite you to be a part of Southwest Voters' efforts, whether it's registering voters, turning out voters, giving a dollar, giving whatever you can afford, because todo cuesta. Water for volunteers and food is expensive. Everything costs. On August the 21st, next week, we're going to be celebrating our 51st anniversary, Southwest Voters 51 years. We have registered 3.6 million Latinos. We have trained 160,000 leaders. Some of them have run for office because we do organizing and candidate training. And we have won 210 voting rights lawsuits. We have changed the world from at large to single member district, and we're suing to protect our voice at the states and at the federal level when we need to. But we're also going to celebrate a champion, Tom Sines, who is the head president and general counsel of the Mexican American Legal Defense. He will be receiving the Southwest Voter Lifetime Achievement Award. For those of you that don't know, he also was the key litigator against Proposition 187. We knew when it passed that it was unconstitutional. There was not enough Latino voters in California to stop it from becoming law. But I'm really glad that those who sued for against the 187, and that ultimately Tom litigated it before the United States Supreme Court, and we won. I hope you can join us, see us at, go to our website, www.svrap.org, and help us empower Latinos, empower communities. And remember that while we're empowering the Latino community, every time we do something to either register a new voter, turn out a new voter, train folks, work with folks, stop democracy from being dismantled, it's helping all of us.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lydia Camarillo, president of Southwest Voter Registration Education Project.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that's the show for today, everyone. Thank you so much. Thanks to our guests, immigration law specialist Lisa Ramirez, Lydia Camarillo, as well as board op D'Angelo Jones, my co-host Jim Lafferty, who will be back with me next week. So until then, get up and stand up for your rights.